Amen. And look at that, Dave. Just by praying, you fixed it. Okay. Well, thanks for coming to this little class. The purpose of this class is in 1 year with 12 sessions to go through the history of the world from creation until the destruction of Jerusalem, and to look at sources outside the Bible and how they fit into the Bible. How does the history of the rest of the world fit into the biblical worldview? Because if you look at the if you go read a textbook today, it'll tell you that the pyramids, the first dynasty in Egypt might have been 4,000 or 5,000 years ago, and they'll tell you that the Sumerians were building cities 3,000 and 4,000 years ago, maybe even 5,000 years ago, and that is not compatible with what the Bible tells us. So we should be able to look at ancient history and make sense of it in terms of the Bible, and that's what the goal of this class is. Okay, so it's not going to be the same as a typical Bible study. We'll read Bible verses sometimes, but this is not like a textual exposition of the Bible. It is what it is. So the first period that we're dealing with is from creation to the flood, which was B.C. 4004 until B.C. 2349. It's a period of 1,656 years. And let's see here. First thing we're going to look at is creation week. When you look in the Bible, we have this description of the creation week. And at the end, it's signed with, it says, these are the generations of the heavens and the earth in the day that they were created. And then we have another story of the fall, which sounds like creation from a different perspective. And it says, these are the generations of Adam. And then we have another section that goes on down the genealogy of Cain, and then the beginning of the flood, and then it says these are the generations of Noah. And there's a theory on this called the Toledoth hypothesis, or the Wiseman hypothesis, named after the man who noticed this. And that is, the book of Genesis is actually written like a series of tablets. And when they dug up ancient cities and they pulled up these tablets, thousands and thousands of clay and stone tablets that these civilizations were writing all their legal transactions, their history, their religion, their business, their loans. They even had banking. When they would have a text that went from maybe covered three or four tablets, they would use what was called a colophon ending, where at the end of one tablet, they would write a phrase, and then they would repeat the phrase at the beginning of the next tablet, because they hadn't invented page numbers yet. And that was how they tied up the tablets to make sure they were reading them in the correct order. And then they would also have a signature by the guy who wrote the tablet at the end. And what Wiseman noticed is that Genesis appears to be a series of tablets where you're seeing the signature of the person, the witness who wrote it. And in one case, the three witnesses, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, who wrote their section. So that Moses wrote, he's the one who wrote down Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. But the Bible never says Moses wrote Genesis. Now, he obviously edited it and put a few comments in there. But Genesis appears to be a compilation of older tablets from before the flood of the actual eyewitnesses to these things that happened, including Adam, including the first one by God himself. So in the creation week, we, kids, what was created on the first day? Anybody know? You're right. You said the heavens and the earth. You're right. And then someone else was also right. So God separated the apart from the land. Well, on the first day. The light from the darkness. All right. So now we have two spaces, the light and the darkness. And on the second day, he separated two things. What were they?
The land.
Hmm? The waters. Which waters? Right, so he separates the waters above from the waters below. And then the third day, what were the two spaces that he separated? He separated the waters from the land. You're a student. Just sit up. You can sit up front if you want. What's your name?
Sissy.
You're good at this. All right, so the first 3 days of creation, God creates six rooms. If you can think of these things he separated as like rooms. And then the next 3 days of creation, he goes back in the same order and he starts populating those rooms with living things. So on the fourth day, what did he create? And Sissy, maybe you should let someone else answer. Anybody? You're right. And what was the space where they live in? And specifically, the sun to govern the day and the moon and stars to govern the night. And then on the day after that, God created what? Exactly. The creatures of the firmament and the sea. And then what did God create on the last day? Yeah?
Humans.
You're right. And animals. You nailed it. And where did they live? You're right, on the land. So God filled up those rooms. And even though God is poetic in the way that he creates, that doesn't mean that he didn't create it that way. There are some academics who will say, oh, see, clearly God's using this literary structure, and it's all a big metaphor, which means not true. Or it could be that God is so creative that he creates in a way that is literary in itself, right? God is poetic, so he sang the universe into existence in a very poetic way. He created spaces, he came back and he filled them. Now, where this gets interesting is one of the first problems for apologetics is evolutionists will say, well, Genesis can't be true because we can see stars that are 40 billion light years away. Maybe 12 billion. We'll go 10 billion, right, just to be conservative. So we see stars that are 10 billion light years away. How could their light could have never gotten to Earth in that 6,000 years, right? So we wouldn't be able to see the stars if the world was actually created 6,000 years ago. Anybody know a solution to that problem? Or maybe we should all just quit and go home?
Apparent age.
Instantaneous light creation. He could have made the light in between. We could just be watching a movie, and actually there are no stars out there. It could just be like a big movie we watch. Say that again. Who said that?
The universe is expanding.
Now you just got very close to what's probably the right answer. It's hard for me to say it is the right answer because I've not been out in space. But has anyone ever heard of the Big Bang? So these scientists, you know, they all do some math, and Big Bang is how the universe came into being, they say. One of the early scientists was named Hubble, and Dr. Hubble came up with a rule. He said that in all of our calculations, we cannot assume that the universe has a center. Because the Bible, he didn't say this, but the reason he said it was, the Bible says the Earth was at the center of the universe when God made the world. And being professional, atheistic physicists, we cannot possibly assume that the Earth is near the center, so therefore we assume the universe has no center. But then they make that assumption, they come up with this physical model for a universe that has no center, and it has like seven dimensions, and it's all bent around, and it's hard to explain for a good reason, probably because it doesn't really make sense. But they say because it has no center, therefore we would expect that anywhere that you are, it looks like you're in the center. The problem is, the math that they use cannot explain, and I just lost my picture, right? It cannot explain the galaxies. Now, these little guys are galaxies. This is the Hubble Deep Space Telescope, and we're looking at this is the farthest reach of anything that humans can see. And this is something like 10,000 times dimmer than what you can see with the naked eye. And when they look to the edge of what we see all these little baby galaxies. This is 1/24 millionth of the sky, and it has 5,000 galaxies. And each galaxy has 100 billion stars. Now, some of them are cool, like spiral galaxies like that one. Some are just kind of roundish. This is a star in the foreground. So for every one star you see in the heavens, this is what's behind it that you can't see. So what we notice when we look way, way in the distance is that these all look young. They say, well, for some reason, when we look as far as we can see, all the galaxies look like they're young and new stars are being formed like babies. And the reason is, apparently, possibly, if you take the math that this creationist physicist did, and you assume that the universe actually does have a center, and that when God created the world, like he said in Genesis, that the universe started as a big ball of water that God starts stretching out and dividing and dividing. So he's stretching out the universe. There's something called an event horizon that you have with very strong gravity. Gravity and time are connected. And when you have very strong gravity, time can actually stop. And actually, time goes faster where there's low gravity, and it goes slower where there's strong gravity. And that's strange, but if you send someone into space and he has a watch on and he stays up there for a while and comes back down, he's actually going to have gained time against the people down here on the ground in higher gravity where time goes a little bit slower. So if the Earth was the last thing to come out of this hole or this big ball of water that God is stretching out to make the universe, the Earth is experiencing time very, very slowly, while everything that's coming out before the Earth is experiencing lots of time. So 40 billion years of time happens, as far as these guys at the outside are concerned, that only 6 days passed on Earth when the Earth pops out of this what's called an event horizon at the end. We look up in the sky and we see 40 billion years worth of time, the light, and we're actually seeing back to creation. So these stars don't look like this today. What we are actually seeing is creation week. When we look out into the heavens beyond 6,000 light years, we're seeing creation. At least that's what Dr. Hartnett says. And, you know, I'm not a professional. But that's our answer to the starlight problem.
Ken, just a moment. Go ahead. Comment on the Big Bang.
Yeah. Yes.
Is that what that movie we went to see the other night, by Del Tacchio of Genesis?
Mm-hmm.
Really, if y'all get a chance, I'm sure it's going to be, out for us to purchase. But it's no surprise, but the Big Bang Theory, even above the secular scientists, has kind of fallen on, bad times.
Indeed. Well, the theory has so many problems. One of the problems is we can see these little galaxies. We can measure how fast they're spinning, and they're spinning too fast. What that means is they're spinning so fast that the gravity that we can, of the mass that we can measure, wouldn't be enough to hold them. They would just fly apart. So they invented this thing called dark matter to fix the model to make it work, and dark energy. But if you assume that the universe has a center and that this happened where the universe was stretched out, that doesn't become a problem. We see them spinning faster because time was actually passing at a higher rate at that time for them than it was passing here. So we're kind of seeing compressed time. All right, so that's into physics. And if you want to read about that, there's a book called Starlight and Time by Baumgartner, and then there's another book by Dr. Stephen Hartnett. And they're real cosmologists, and for those of you young men and ladies who are really into the details, you can get those books. And
okay.
So let's talk about the environment before the flood in the Garden of Eden. Before the flood, we're told about dinosaurs, and dinosaurs were huge. Like, how big? Any kids, what was the biggest dinosaur? T-Rex. Anybody want to hazard another guess? No? T-Rex was big. T-Rex is bigger than I want to meet, right? He's 40 feet long. There's one called a Gigantosaurus that was 100 feet long. But he was apparently a plant eater. But you don't want to be standing underneath him when he decides to lay down, right? Because he probably weighed about 200 tons.
I happen to have a shoulder mount of a T-Rex if anybody's not seen it. It was one of the things I had to remove from the land when I first came up here.
But that dinosaurs weren't the only thing that was big. When we look in the fossil record is things that were killed in the flood. So it's like a record we have of the world before the flood. And guess what? This thing is about 12 feet long. Anyone want to guess what kind of animal that is?
Cat.
That is a fossilized... they call it an American lion because they found the fossil in America, but the lions were 12 feet long before the flood. And it wasn't just the lions. This is a dragonfly fossil, and this is the size of a normal today size, the biggest dragonfly we have today, and that is the size of a dragonfly in stone. Now, this is actually pretty close. That's not, this is maybe 20% bigger, right, than a real dragonfly. That's the biggest one. Can you imagine meeting a dragonfly whose wingspan is 3 feet? Might carry off your kids. And this, has anyone ever turned over a rock and you find these little bugs that roll up in a ball and you play with them?
Roly-poly.
That, how would you like to meet a roly-poly who's 5 feet long? You could probably invent a new sport with those guys. Okay, so before the flood, everything was huge. Before I go to that. So scientists have, they try to find out about the world in the ancient past, and we, even though they're evolutionists, they actually do dig up facts that are useful. They're studying things, and sometimes the information they get is actually useful to help us understand the world if we put it in the right context of a biblical worldview. So the scientists spent a lot of effort popping little air bubbles that are found in amber, little bubbles of air that were trapped in pine resin and got sealed up and turned into rock and have been sitting there in like little sealed time capsules for however long it's been since that was created. And they think they're millions of years old. But they found that these little air bubbles have 35% oxygen consistently. And now, kids, does anyone know how much oxygen the atmosphere has today?
21.
Who said that? All right, yeah. You still count as a kid. Yeah, okay. Yes, 21%. So that means if it was 35 before, it's 21 now that we're missing about 40% of the oxygen that used to be in the atmosphere. It's not there anymore. That probably explains why things were bigger, because bugs today could not get that big, because bugs don't have lungs. They don't have a circulatory system like we do. So they rely on gas exchange through a bunch of holes in the side of them and just like, you know, air kind of going in there and carbon dioxide coming out. Well, if you had 35% oxygen, the creatures that rely on that kind of breathing can get a lot bigger. And regular creatures with lungs, like dinosaurs and people, would also get bigger. So there's a very good chance that before the flood, people, just regular people, were probably 10 feet tall. And the Jews, the legends of the Jews say that Adam was over 10 feet tall. All right. One of the questions is, what happened to the dinosaurs? And I know that Ken Ham has devoted a lot of work to this, and I can't touch those guys in terms of the quality. But I have noticed one thing that I've not heard any of them ever mention. And that is, what is the connection between the dinosaurs and the curse? Because there's one major section of creatures that's missing today that used to be here. And God cursed a certain kind of animal. What could that connection be? Well, let's think about it. When God told Adam that in the day that you eat that fruit, you will surely die, how long did it take for him to die? Anybody? How long did it take Adam to die from after the fruit?
Over 900 years.
Right? Yeah, so I can see you can read. that was actually a literary test, parents. Sorry.
Oh, it's a
self
question. Okay.
So, and then God made a promise to the woman that her seed would crush the serpent's head. How long did that take? Until Jesus came. All right, someone else can read. All right. Okay. So if God cursed the serpent to go on his belly in the same time he made those other two promises, is it possible that it wasn't fulfilled just like that, but that it took time? It might have taken thousands of years. And what we see in history is there are many depictions of people and dinosaurs, and people killing dinosaurs and dinosaurs killing people. And in later, when we get down to later parts of antiquity, I'm actually going to show you a lot of those pictures and drawings and paintings and statues where people have been depicting dinosaurs for most of human history. It's just in the last few hundred years, but especially since Christ came, they've been getting scarcer and scarcer to now we are convinced that they're extinct, and maybe they are. Maybe there's a few of them left hiding somewhere. But is it possible that when God cursed the serpent, that serpent meant reptile? Even the word reptile is related to the word serpent, S-R-P-N-T. Reptile is basically the same Hebrew root word. What if God was cursing the walking and flying serpents because he said, you will go on your belly, you will lick the dust. So, okay, here's another test. This is an intelligence test, kids. Show me something in this picture that is not a serpent. Anybody? I think there's two, sorry, not a serpent. What I mean reptile. There's two creatures in this picture that are not reptiles. Okay, we got it. Yep, the mammoth and the saber-toothed tiger. I did the best I could for a good dinosaur silhouettes. So what we have, these are the pre-flood dinosaurs, the pre-flood reptiles. We got flyers, we got walkers, we got two-legged walkers. What we have are some very agile reptiles. And now we look at the reptiles we had today with a couple that aren't reptiles. Anybody know who's the one that doesn't belong in here? Yep, got a frog, got a toad. So apparently the people making illustrations these days don't know their animal kingdom. But, oops. So what these guys have, so the snake, he goes with his belly on the ground, but the turtle pretty much does too. And even an alligator does. Other lizards, most of the time their belly is dragging on the ground. Even if they can get up and walk, most of the time their belly is on the ground. So I call these the humble serpents. And I believe that the extinction of the dinosaurs was God's curse, and that is a sign of God's victory over the serpent, and that it was on purpose. But I could be wrong. In depicting the Garden of Eden, it's funny how medieval authors, a lot of times, they'll have a snake with the head of a person. This is the only one I've found where you actually have a serpent with wings who's tempting the woman. I suspect he looked more like this. Okay. Yeah, he might have been prettier. You know, he was trying to be persuasive, right? Not the whole threatening thing. Okay. Skip to astronomy. So the world before the flood is actually created the foundation of our system of math and science. Specifically, even the way that we count numbers, the way that we measure degrees in a circle, are units of weight and measurement. And I'm going to, next lecture will be about the flood, and we're going to specifically talk about how the flood changed the motions of the earth and the moon. But there's a lot of evidence that shows that before the flood, the month was 30 days, the year was 360 days, and the moon was not at this angle. The moon was in the same plane as the ecliptic of the sun, which would have meant that you'd have every month on the full moon, you'd have a lunar eclipse every month, clockwork. And if the year was 360 days and the month was 30 days, as the moon went through the year, every month the full moon would be in the same spot. So in this month, it would be in against the constellation in the background. The moon would be full in the middle of Taurus, the constellation of a big bull. And then a few months later, the moon is full in the month of Gemini. And so, and then the next, it's full in the month of Cancer, or in the constellation of Cancer. And so apparently Adam and Seth named the constellations after what they called the houses of the moon. Later, after the flood, they changed it to the name houses of the sun. And they were basically using these constellations to tell a story. And part of the story that they told was the story of the fall and the story of that there's a serpent who's trying to grab this crown. There's a crown in the sky called Aurora Borealis. You've got the serpent who's trying to get the crown. You've got this hero named Perseus who's fighting the serpent. You've got a constellation named Virgo, which is a virgin woman who's been knocked down on the ground, but she's holding in her hand a sheaf of wheat, which means the seed. And what it was is this was a way that they used to tell the story of what they'd been promised from God in the Garden of Eden. This was a version of what's called the Proto-Evangelion or the Proto-Gospel. Later, as this was corrupted, they started worshiping the sun, moon, and stars and turned it into astrology and started trying to figure out if they should date people from whatever star sign or all the things that they did as pagans. They sacrificed the sun, moon, and stars. So God condemned that, but the original reason and the original purpose for which God made the sun, moon, and stars is still there. So one of the effects of this is that Adam and Seth, according to Josephus, they basically started the science of astronomy and they passed it down to us, and we inherited this through the Babylonians, is that they took 360 days of the year to get 1 degree. So 1 degree was 1/360th. It was how far the sky moved in 1 day. And then they measured how far the earth turned underneath that, and that's how they got distance. And they actually got to where 36 seconds of a month gave a side that's 10 centimeters, and they cubed that to get what turned out to be, they called it the sela, which is almost exactly the same as a liter. And they called this other unit, if you filled it with water, it would weigh 1 kilogram, which for them they called that the double manna. And we thought the French came up with the metric system. But it's much older than that, and the reason it's older than that is it's based on the actual motions of the heavens that God designed. Okay, and I've got a book on that called Civilization One, where these guys go into great detail. If this interests you, you can get that book. Okay, and there are also good books about the gospel and the stars, which I'm not going to go into that much.
Oh, wait, we got to go back to that. That's too good.
Well, There's a book by a guy named Bullinger called The Gospel and the Stars. Now, Danny Faulkner, who works for Answers in Genesis, he hates that book. He's an astronomer who doesn't think the gospel is in the stars. I think that the gospel is in the stars. So, yeah. You can read the book and make up your own mind. Okay, now in the Garden of Eden, we have the foundation of a lot of problems that we have today. When the serpent comes to the woman, he says, did God really say? So the first thing is he questions the word of God. And we have a culture today that questions the word of God. We don't believe the Bible. We don't believe God actually wrote this word. Did God really say this? Or, you know, did somebody just make that up? The second thing the serpent did is he says, well, God's just trying to hold you back from reaching your full potential, right? Did he say those exact words? No, but he said you can be as gods if you eat the fruit, right? So today's New Agey type religion people would say, well, you know, God is trying to hold you back from your full potential by issuing all that negativity, right? But God gave them the law, and the law was very simple. It was, you can eat from any tree, just not that one. You know what would have happened if they had obeyed God? They would have gained the knowledge of good and evil through obedience. And they would have presumably been allowed to eat from the tree later because they'd obeyed God and they had gained the knowledge through obedience. Instead, by eating the fruit, they gained the knowledge of good and evil through disobedience, through finding out what evil was. And that was the beginning of many of our problems. Maybe all of them. Second thing is we have the beginning of both Marxism and feminism. God has established an order where God commands the man who tells the woman and not to eat the fruit. And together, God had given the man and woman dominion over the animals. But here you have an animal telling the woman to tell the man he's wrong about God and to disobey. And so what you have is a complete turning upside down of the authority structure. The animal is now directing the human, and the woman is directing her husband. And the husband is disobeying God. So that, in a nutshell, is Marxism. And Karl Marx merely re-articulated the most ancient of all heresies. Now, what's interesting, what happened after the flood, after the fall, they get kicked out of the Garden of Eden. And we have some sources from India, like the Dot Indians over in India. They have a document called the Rig Veda. And in the Rig Veda, which is a very, very old Aryan document, they tell the story from before the flood, and they call the line of Cain the crocodiles, and they call the line of Seth the elephants. And they say that the elephants stayed near the Garden of Eden, and they were trying to be righteous, but the crocodiles were very violent, and they would steal, they were sexually immoral, and they would murder. And today we have this debate in politics between several, basically socialism, Marxism. You've got conservatives, who it's hard to say exactly what their ism is, because it keeps changing as time goes by. They're kind of just 20 years behind everybody else. We've got theonomy, which is the articulation of God's law. And then you've got this thing called libertarianism. And libertarianism says that really there shouldn't be a state. If you're like a hardcore libertarian, there should not be a state. The state is not legitimate. But that we should just we should solve all of our problems just through asking someone else to judge between us, and that we don't need the state. Well, we tried that for 1,656 years. That was called the world before the flood. There was no state. God had not given the power of the sword. And what happened? The world became so full of corruption, of sexual immorality, of violence and idolatry, that God ended up sending the flood, wiping the whole earth clean, starting over with Noah. And then what does he do? As soon as Noah gets off the ark, what does God tell him? Whoever sheds the blood of man, anybody know? Yes. God gave capital punishment. He gave the sword of the magistrate after the flood to act as an immune system to keep the world from descending into the level of evil that he had to destroy it again. So libertarianism has been tried and failed. So during this time that you've got people running around before the flood, they're living 800 years, 900 years, if they don't get murdered. They had, when you think about the potential they had to develop science, to develop music, I mean, we're fortunate to have 20, 40 good years. You know, it takes us 20 years just to learn everything we need to know, just to get up to speed, to get started. And then we work 40 years, and then we retire, and then we die. They could have worked for 400 years on whatever their skill was. And so when Solomon says there's nothing new under the sun, it applies to all kinds of things, but I think it also applies to technology. And we're going to see a little bit of evidence that they had high technology before the flood. One of the other things that they did is they were worshiping Eve as the mother goddess. And I think maybe the way that this happened was, if you think about it, I remember my great-grandmother, and when we were kids, Mom would take us way back to the mountains where our family came from and go up to the cave, no, actually, at the house, and the little house up on the mountain, and take us to see our great-grandmother, and she would hold the baby in her arms, and she couldn't possibly remember our names because she has so many great-grandchildren, but she remembers this is Linda, you're Linda's boy or you're Linda's girl. So she remembers her grandchildren, and she remembers that way. And you can imagine if Eve lived 800 years, that women who were worried about conception, women who were concerned about, I haven't been able to get pregnant, she would have been the ultimate great-grandmother, like the super great-grandmother. And she lived so long that they were basically, they started to think of her as someone who had supernatural powers to give them what they wanted, to seek her blessing. And seeking blessing is biblical. It's just not biblical if you turn it into idolatry. So that is the oldest religion in the world other than humanism. So what we find, even in the Middle East, the oldest examples we have of religion are mother goddess figurines, where people were making idols of Eve. And I guess if you had a great-grandmother who lived to be 800 and everybody was always bringing her cookies, she might start looking like that. Okay, so Cain killed Abel, and the Greeks remember Cain as Hephaestus. And Cain, he was the first self-conscious secular humanist, okay, in his own power, right? He killed Abel, and God comes to him, and now he's scared. Is he scared that God's going to judge him for killing Abel? No. What's he scared of? Anybody? What was Cain afraid of? That someone else is going to kill him. You'll see this with guilt. People with guilty consciences project their own guilt onto other people. So if someone walks up to you that you've never met, say, hey, how are you doing? You know, I'm the most truthful guy you'll ever meet. There's a real good chance he's a liar. Because an honest person, it doesn't even occur to them to tell you that, right? It's someone who has a guilty conscience who starts projecting and trying to cover their own guilty conscience. So Cain had murdered. Now he's worried that he's going to be murdered. Well, God had not given the state yet. There was no capital punishment. So God puts a mark on Cain so that Cain can't be killed, so that no one will kill Cain. Now, Cain should have responded to that. That was God showing him grace. He should have responded to that with repentance. But what we see is that Cain responded instead with self-justification. He took it as a license to now act this way. So 7 generations later, Lamech says, I killed a man, I killed 2 men because they insulted me. And if Cain was avenged 7 times, well, Lamech is avenged 70 times 7. Which reminds us later of what Jesus said about forgiving people 70 times 7. Jesus says the opposite of what the line of Cain said. So by the time Noah comes around, and there's evidence that one of these two ladies that was the daughter of Lamech ended up on the ark as the wife of Ham. The line of Cain had become so self-consciously wicked that they felt justified in killing anybody who insulted them. All right, let's talk about technology. So we saw that mathematically, the people before the flood based their math on the heavenly bodies. We keep finding things buried in stones, and usually it's just animal remains. But every now and again, we actually find artifacts from before the flood, buried 2,000 feet down or even on the surface, but they're encased in rock. So this is a metal hammer that was found in Texas somewhere, encased in limestone. This is a shoe sole that was fossilized and apparently had a metal shank inside of it. And they had scientists looking at it from like Harvard and stuff, and they said, wow, that's the most amazing, coincidental, natural reproduction of a man-made object we've ever seen. A lot of these objects are found in coal, and when people burn more coal, you'd hear cases. This was in Oklahoma. Someone broke open a piece of coal to put it in the fireplace, and a steel pot fell out. That's happened with gold necklaces. This is a bell that came out of a lump of coal. So the remains of the pre-flood world are all strewn about through the rock. And there's not a lot of it, but there's enough that they pop up from time to time. In Siberia, they did a drill core, and they pulled out what appear to be brass and other advanced alloys that were screws. And these things are like really tiny. It's blown up real big, but that looks like pretty modern technology there. And now check this out. In this rock, we have what appears to be some kind of electrical plug sticking out. And it's been examined, and the rock formed around it, not the other way around. So they may have had anything that we have, anything conceptually that we have. Solomon said there's nothing new under the sun. People were living 800 years, and they were a lot smarter than we are. Rather than thinking that we are the pinnacle of technology, it's more likely that we have yet to reach the peaks of technology that the people before the flood did. Okay, 3 crimes that destroyed the world. And this will come to play in the law of Moses later. The first crime is idolatry, rejecting the God who made us and making new gods, whether it be ourselves, the serpent, or the sun, moon, and stars, or Buddha. That is the one that leads to the others. Next comes sexual immorality, which is rejecting marriage, which God gave us. Now, in Genesis, God gives sexual immorality. He gives us a positive command. Be fruitful and multiply, each after your own kind. And that was enough for Satan to say, do the opposite. right? And we're going to get to that in a minute. So sexual immorality spreads, and then the fruit of sexual immorality is bloodshed. What we see a lot in boys who grow up in a family with no father, who grew up in out of marriage, they tend to be more likely to become criminals because the law is taught to us, even though it may be written on our hearts, or the evidence of the law is written on our hearts, we don't obey it unless we have a parent to teach it to us. And for boys especially, they need a father to teach it to them, usually with a rod on the backside. So bloodshed, and we see this with abortion. First, we embrace sexual immorality, and then abortion is we demand abortion to be able to keep doing sexual immorality, and that's what's happening today. Okay, this is a passage that's very controversial in Genesis chapter 6, and I'm going to use this passage to show you something that's frequently found in the Bible. It's a literary structure called a chiasm. It's also called a ring structure. It's where you have a stair step of ideas. So you have the first idea is A, the second idea is B, the third idea, which is the central point, is C. But then it'll go back and repeat B, and then it'll go back and repeat A. So here we have, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born to them. I'm not reading this. I cut a little bit of it out so it would fit on the screen here. The sons of God saw the daughters of men, and they took wives for themselves. Right? And then the Lord said, His spirit shall strive with man forever, and his days shall be limited to 120 years. And we go back to, there were giants on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. So there are two theories on this. One is that the sons of God were the line of Seth, who were righteous, and the daughters of men were the line of Cain, who was unrighteous, and that this was basically the men of the covenant taking wives who weren't of the covenant and having unbelieving children. And that makes sense, especially later in history, because that's a major theme in the time of Israel, right? Of God has separated you out from the nations. Part of the problem, though, is that, well, let's not say the problem. Let's say the other theory on this is that the sons of God are actually a reference to angelic beings who came down, saw daughters of men, took them, and had offspring with them that turned out to be monstrous and gigantic and evil. So those are the two theories on that. And the Jews, up until the first century, they believed that they were angels. Philo was the first Jew who started allegorizing the Bible, and so he was one of the ones who said, well, it was actually the line of Seth intermarrying with the line of Cain. So I'm going to leave it to you all. I'm leaving that one open because I'm not going to answer that question. I don't think any of us can absolutely answer the question of which one was correct. But what we do see with Satan, he has a pattern which we see in Genesis, we see it today. The pattern is Satan wants to be as God, so he covets the image of God. And he sees in man has the image of God in a way that the angels don't. So the image of God is more than just intelligence, because angels are intelligent, right? What is the special relationship between God the Father and God the Son? God, the Father begot the Son before all eternity is what we're taught, right? Angels were not made to beget children. Okay, now animals reproduce, but they don't have a spirit. Man, who is a little lower than the angels, but who is higher than the animals, man has a spirit like God does. But man also begets sons like God, like the relationship between God the Father and God the Son. And I don't want to go too far with that because anywhere you're talking about the Trinity is dangerous. it's a complicated subject. But what we see is that Satan desires to, first of all, destroy the image of God, the legitimate image of God, and then he wants to steal that image for himself. So he wants to seduce the women away from righteous men and get them to bear offspring who will become children of the serpent. And that could be metaphorical, and it may also have possibly been literal. We don't really know enough about angels to know if they could, if they've got the equipment to create offspring. But I'm sure that they might try. They might have wanted to try. So the point being, and you see this all through Genesis, is the serpent constantly attacks the woman. He attacks the woman so he can attack the righteous children and replace them with his own. And that's the pattern that we deal with. Okay, so now we've reached the end of Act 1. Oh, wait, got to go back. So, on that subject, we see a question a lot now in science fiction as well as NASA. They're obsessed with this one question. Are we alone in the universe? Anybody have an opinion? Are there other life forms in outer space? Anybody? Yes? No? Maybe? Anybody?
Maybe it depends on what you mean by other life
form. Oh, good question. Good clarification. So expound on that, Ruth. Okay, well, maybe it's not. On the first day, God separates light and darkness. And then on the fourth day, he populates the heavens with the sun, moon, and stars, which he calls the heavenly host. Now, later in Scripture, he talks about the angels, and he calls them the heavenly host. And heavenly host is used for both the sun, moon, and stars, and the angels interchangeably throughout the Bible. The word heaven in the Bible means what you see when you look up. It means the sky. It doesn't mean some other plane that I think we've kind of developed in the last 500 years. Our idea of heaven in the church tends to be an invisible place that nobody sees. But the Bible says God separated the heavens from the earth and that he put the stars in the heaven and that heaven is God's throne, the earth is God's footstool. It's telling us that when we look into the heavens, we are looking into the heavens. So the sun and moon and stars are where the angels live. I don't know. The Apostle Paul says that there are earthly bodies and there are heavenly bodies, and we refer to the things in the sky as heavenly bodies. I'm not saying that they are the same. They could be. We just don't know a lot about angels, and we really don't know a lot about stars. We look out into the heavens, and we can measure them, and we come up with theories about, well, it's got this mass, and we think that fusion is what drives it. But I think that we're a lot like a little ant in the forest who comes up on a man sleeping, and the ant doesn't have a very long lifespan, and he watches the man, maybe this little ant scientist, and he's measuring the rate at which the man breathes. You know, he sees the chest going up and down as the sleeping man is breathing. And he comes up with all these theories as to what this sleeping man is, but he has no idea what it really is because he's only seen it in one state. So I think that we should be careful not to assume that scientists know nearly as much as they think they do about the universe. That the heavens is where the angelic beings live, whether they live on stars or maybe they can turn on like stars. You know, we have physical bodies, maybe they have electromagnetic bodies. We just don't know, and we don't want to go too wild with speculation. But what we do have here is a theme that we do know is true, and that is that some of them came down and rebelled, and they invaded the earth, and the Bible calls them demons. And it tells us that God actually locked some of them in Hades. It says this in Jude and in Peter. Some of the ones that sinned before the flood, he locked them up so that they couldn't do any more damage. But we see demonic activity in the world, so we have these things that we know are here, and they seem to want to possess bodies of humans or animals, right? And they encourage wickedness. They're intelligent. Well, we also have this theme in science fiction of there's these things that live out there and they invade the Earth. And well, this happened in history. They invaded in history. And science fiction is just taking that same story and recasting it for us as if we'd never seen it before, when actually we have seen the story before. There are malevolent creatures out there of some kind that came down, and now we are doing battle with them because they want to control us, they want to enslave us, they want to own us, and they want to replace the image of God with their own image. So that's all. I'm not claiming either of the theories on the Nephilim. I'm just kind of putting some perspective on it, that either way you look at it, the world that we have is actually very similar to the world that the science fiction people imagine, except maybe not quite the way they imagine it. So, okay.
The truth is stranger than fiction. Is that what it is?
That could be. Yeah.
And you know, it seems to me always so arrogant that the scientists who have, you know, over the generations, over the time, been proven wrong. Present moment, they always claim that this is scientific and therefore absolute truth.
Yep. Like science is like the Oracle of Delphi. We went to the Oracle and science said this, right? When you see it in the newspaper, well, scientists have discovered that, and they don't tend to mention that scientists undiscovered something else that they realized they were wrong about.
I have several Christian brothers who I love. But they will not believe in six-day creation. They will not believe in Genesis chapter 1 through 11 because they're scientists.
But they'll believe, it's interesting, a lot of these atheists are now believing what they call Anunnaki. They're saying that, well, maybe life didn't evolve here. Maybe it evolved somewhere else in the galaxy and intelligent beings brought it here and they seeded the Earth with life, and they built the pyramids, and they were really advanced. Well, what are they doing? They're just moving the problem to the other side of the universe, but we still have the problem that random processes cannot create anything. But a lot of the story that they're talking about, this Anunnaki, that's exactly what the people did at the Tower of Babel, is after Babel, they created a religion about their ancestors. And they said that they actually lived in heaven, and they came down from heaven, and they made us on the earth. They're rejecting the revelation of Scripture, and they're replacing it with a new revelation. So the atheists, well, first they were just pure materialist atheists, and we arose from slime, you know, worms to people. But now they're like, okay, well, maybe these other beings are out there that came and created us. So what's happening? The atheists are moving toward polytheism. They claim to be atheists, but now we're finding out, well, they really are willing to believe in something else out there as long as it's not the one in the Bible. Yeah. So here we are at the end of Act 1 in the Bible, the flood. We've got Abel's blood and all the other innocent people crying out from the ground. We've got Cain's corrupt offspring dominating the world with violence and immorality. Enoch, is recorded, he preached to the unbelievers. And Seth's line are staying near the Garden of Eden. They're sacrificing to God. They're worshiping God. But they're holding on to hope, but it probably looks pretty dark for them. You know, when you see the whole world is gone bad. And we could probably relate to that in, you know, the times that we live in, and I'm sure that other people have. We don't live in the only dark time in history. There have been many, many dark times in history where it looked like the odds are all against us. There is no way that the people of God are going to be able to hold up against this wave of the tidal wave of evil. But God always has the next act, and that's what we're going to learn about next time. So thank you very much for having the patience to sit through my presentation.